Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
Zechariah, as you know, has been extremely difficult to interpret for the very simple fact that it's ambiguous. Now, I am a student of the Bible, and if the Bible affirms it clearly, I want to affirm it. But where I really get in problems is when the Bible's not clear exactly what it's affirming. I want to affirm what I can, but I do not want to affirm what I'm uncertain of, because I feel like that we make the Bible say much too much with our presuppositions than it really does in context. And the book of Zechariah has been that kind of a book. There are, and the reason it is, and if you ever see this in the Old Testament, it's really going to help your study of the Old Testament. What the prophets do is they use past occurrences to describe future events, or they use contemporary problems and circumstances to foreshadow future events. And so what we have is often very difficult to know if we're speaking about something that's happened in the past, something that's happening right now, or something that's going to happen in the future. And that's the problem of chapter 10. As you know, Zechariah is a post-exilic prophet, so he lives after the return from the Babylonian exile. That return began in 538 B.C. with the decree of Cyrus. The second temple was rebuilt under the encouragement of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah. Malachi is going to terminate this period around 450 B.C. So we're in a period where the Persian Empire is dominant, and in a time where they're trying to reestablish the struggling nation. It's going to be both people from the northern kingdom, the people from the southern kingdom, reunited in the people of God. It's a very hard time, difficult time. They need encouraging. They're so little. There's so many problems. They're struggling so. Those who saw the first temple, the beauty of Solomon's temple with its gold and its polished limestone, when they saw the second temple, it was really sad. The old men wept because they knew the difference. Well, that's the kind of setting we're in. And obviously, this prophet is wanting to encourage these people, build them up, say, hang in there, it's going to get better. Some of this chapter definitely applies to that kind of thing. But, as you know, from the last few chapters in Zechariah, there are obvious references to the Messiah. So, it's not only that struggling time in the end of the beginning of the Persian period, but it's referring to the time when God will break into history when His people are struggling again and do a mighty work. So, it's hard to lock down this thing, and that's why it's going to be so ambiguous to us. But the whole Old Testament prophecy is like that. To complicate that even further, this chapter is poetry. Now, you do not interpret poetry the way you interpret the AJ. I hope you don't. You get some radical stuff. And so some of these are going to be metaphors and figures of speech and historical allusions, and we'll do the best we can, but we cannot be as dogmatic in prophetic poetry as we can in Matthew chapter 4. That's what I'm trying to say. Historical narrative, it's much easier to be certain about than prophetic poetry. And that's why I think we're going to struggle some with exactly what it means. Let's begin then. As you know, the chapter division in your Bible is not inspired. Neither is the verse division. It was done during the Middle Ages for one purpose, so everybody could quickly find the same passage. That's the only reason for it. But the guy who did it, I think, had hiccups and really fouled up some of these chapters. So verse 1 of chapter 10 obviously goes with chapter 9. At the end of chapter 9, we're talking about the grain will be good, the wine will be good. The rain of chapter 10 is obviously goes with that agricultural metaphor of abundance. And so, ask, and it's an imperative, by the way, ask rain from the Lord at the time of the spring rain. The Lord who makes the storm clouds, He will give them showers of rain, vegetation in the field to each man. Now, as you know, Israel had had a problem before the exile in worshiping Baal, which is the fertility god, male fertility god, and Ashtoreth or Astarte, you know, which is the female fertility god. So the whole point here is God's the giver of rain, not Baal. And God will give rain, and He'll give abundance in appropriate times. And His people, now, you may think it's dumb for these farmers to ask for rain, but it's as biblical as it can be. Now, you may think it rains just because a cold front moves in, the guy on the 6 o'clock news says it's going to, but God's involved in this. He's involved in the moment-by-moment operation of His universe. And so the Bible says that God's the giver of rain, which for an agricultural people is absolute life, okay? Notice where it mentions the storm clouds. You know a lot of the metaphors of the Bible depict God as a storm God. And the reason for that is on Mount Sinai, when God came down, He came down in fire and smoke and lightning. And it was like a thunderstorm on the top of that mountain. And so the ideal of God as a storm God developed. Many times in the Psalms, He rides in the storm clouds. Well, that's the idea. Okay. Now, in verse 2, break the whole context. It's totally different. Many people try to relate verse 2 to verse 1 and say they're divining for rain. I think that's totally inappropriate. I think verse 2 is a radical switch. Now, here's my question. Does verse 2 apply to Zechariah's day, apply to the future, or apply to the past? My opinion, it applies to the past. I think what he's going to do, he's going to say, this is the way it was, this is the way it's going to be. And so he's going to go back using the language of Jeremiah and Ezekiel to describe the horrors and the apostasy of the life of the people of God just before the exile. Now, after the exile, Israel got cured of sucking eggs right there. No more idolatry after that exile. So I think this is pre-exilic. Now, let's look what it says. For the terrapin, now terrapin or teraphin is a name that is used in the Old Testament for household gods. Now, we think they're in the form of human beings. Let me give you a few examples here, if I could. Genesis 31:19, Judges 17:5, Judges 18:5, 1 Samuel 19:13. Okay. The reason this is not considered flagrant idolatry is because somehow these household gods are identified with Yahweh. People are trying to seek the future from Yahweh through these kinds of idols. Now, we get that specifically from Judges 17:5 and Judges 18:5. Now, some of these idols were pretty big. In 1 Samuel 19:13, Saul's after David. He sneaks out the back window and his wife puts the teraphim in the bed with her and covers him up like he's David. Now, that's a pretty big idol, friends and neighbors. You can put him in the bed and he'd look like a man. So, the size differentiated, but that's what these are. Now, they speak iniquity, which means they're not true revealers. The second one. And the diviners see lying visions. Now, divination is spoken often in the Old Testament. It is a way of interpreting the future by means of two things: natural phenomenon and man-made phenomenon. Example, in Babylon, the most widely practiced form of telling the future was the reading of livers. It's called heptoscopy. You do that in medicine, read livers. And they would cut open a sheep and see what its liver looked like. If it looked good, there's a good day. If it looked bad, bad day. Or they would read the flock of birds. You know, if an owl flew and you went up into your nose, there's bad days coming. And so they would read birds and stars, all kinds of stars and planets. Now, the other kind was man-made stuff, like give a guy a cup of tea and let him drink it and have the tea leaves were at the end, and you look at those tea leaves. Or you take arrows in your hand, you drop the arrows, you see how they lay. Or the Urim and the Thummim, remember that, in the high priest ephod? That's the same kind of thing. It's a diviner's tool to know what God's will is. Now, if you want a couple of passages that really put the bite on this, it'd be Deuteronomy 18, verses 9 through 13, where divination is listed with sorcery and necromancy and all of that. So it is forbidden for the people of God. Next we have, and tell lying dreams. Now, you may want to see Ezekiel chapter 22, verse 28, where these lying dreams are mentioned. The whole book of Jeremiah talks about this. The prophets were saying, everything's good, everything's fine, God's going to bring peace. And Jeremiah said, it's a lie. judgment's coming, destruction's coming, death is coming. So they kept preaching good news, he kept preaching bad news, and God was with him. That's what the deal is. Now in Deuteronomy 13, 1 through 5, it says, it talks about dreamers and dreams. It says, even if someone dreams and it comes true, if he does it in any other name but the name of the Lord, he's a false prophet and the Lord's testing you. So there's a good sign that even miracles or predictive prophecy that's not linked to God is false. And so that may be a part of that here. Now, see what it says, and they comfort in vain. Well, there's that idea. The word vain is the Old Testament word for vanity, nothingness. It's the word used for idol. An idol is nothing, and that's what the word the Jewish people picked. Then look at the next word. Look in your Bible. It says, now mine's New American Standard. It says, therefore the people wander like sheep. Now, in your Bible, does it have the people? No? Shouldn't in some. What kind do you have, Monty? What translation? What does it have? Just they wander? The they is ambiguous, right? See, what New American Standard has done for you, they've interpreted what's not in the Hebrew text. Now, if you'll notice your New American Standard, it should be in italics, is it? So they're supplying what they think it is, but that's not in the text. Now, it could very well be that the dreamers that are just being spoken of are wandering away from God. And so the people may not be accurate. Okay, like sheep, they are afflicted because there is no shepherd. Now, all through the ancient Near East, leaders were called shepherds. Even Hammurabi, which is the first legal code we know that predates the Mosaic legislation, even from 2000 B.C. Egyptian cuneiform tablets, the leaders were called shepherds. So when God is called shepherd, he's a common name for leaders all over that part of the world. Now, the classical passage, I think, of God being called a shepherd is Genesis 49:24, and his people being called sheep are in Numbers 27:17. So when we get to John 10, the New Testament, and Jesus he's called the good shepherd, and his people are the sheep, it's a very common biblical theme we're picking up on. Nothing new in that idea. Now, the shepherds, as far as the people are concerned, you see the next verse where it says, my anger is kindled against the shepherds. When it's used of not kings or gods, it's used of civil and religious leaders. That may be big ones or little ones, but just all the leaders, civil and religious. Okay, so that's who the shepherds is. So God is angry at the shepherds. Now, if you want a passage that will blow your shoes off, you ought to read Ezekiel 34. Now, he is ticked at the leaders, I want to tell you. Some people are very bothered by any mention of God's anger. And I want to say to you that anger is an anthropomorphic phrase, which means we're speaking about God by putting human emotions on him. But what do you think God's love is? It's an anthropomorphic phrase, putting a human emotion on God. The same book that tells us God is love and gone so far to redeem us is the same book that tells us that God gets angry when people rebel against his will. And you can't have one without the other. They're both in the same book. So God does have, and that's not a temper tantrum in heaven, but it is a settled opposition against man's rebellion and destruction of his creation. And so, God's anger. Now, I will punish the male goats. Then it says, for the Lord of hosts has visited his flock, the house of Judah. Now, the word visited in the Bible can mean visited for blessing or visited for judgment. Both words are used in the Exodus. He visited them in Egypt, and he visited them again with the plagues. And so, it can mean either one. Now, I think we've talked about the pre-exilic time, and I think we're coming to talk about the post-exilic time. You see how the time frame shifts? And I'm not sure it shifts, but I just think it does. I think God's talking about blessing now, because from here on down, in this same paragraph, you can see there's no division in your text. On the way down, it's going to talk about the blessings of God. Now, before was the reason that God judged Israel, these diviners, these false leaders, and all that problem. But he's going to bless them now. And so we're moving into a new section. Then in verse 4 it says, last of verse 3, and he will make them like his majestic horse in battle. Now, war horses were something relatively late after Solomon. They drove chariots. Cavalry was something that was developed. So here is Judah dressed up like a war horse. Now, why would God want to have a war horse? Well, we're going to start using holy war terminology. What we're doing is going back to the days of Joshua, when the people were fighting in God's name, and we're going to use that for the days of Judah, when so many nations are against her again. Okay? Now, look at your Bible real close in verse 4, and let me see if yours reads just like mine. Look at word for word. From them will come the cornerstone. You have just that? Somebody, what do you have? You have H-I-M, him. Now, King James, that's the Masoretic text. That is the Hebrew. Now, what happened is, people don't know what the him means. Now, there's one of three possibilities. The him means God, possible. The him means Judah. Or the him means, guess who? The Messiah. Now, let's see if I can give you the evidences for both. Contextually, which one do you think it is? Just reading on down, which seems most logical? Judah or God? Probably Judah. But the Jewish Targums, which is the Aramaic commentary on the Hebrew Scriptures before the New Testament time, calls this a messianic reference. They call it King Messiah. So the Jews themselves interpreted this as messianic. I think it's messianic for this reason. Look at the names. The cornerstone, the tent peg, the bow of battle. You say, so those are all messianic names. The cornerstone comes from Isaiah 28:16, where Jesus is called the chief cornerstone. The tent peg is really a large peg, and it comes from a messianic reference in Isaiah 22:22-23. Now, the bow of war is not so much a definite reference, but in Exodus, I think it's 15:3, the Messiah is spoken of as God's champion in war. So I think those are messianic titles. So I think it's probably a reference to the Messiah, though I really can't be dogmatic. It may simply be God. Now let's see what it says. From him will come the cornerstone, from him the large peg, from him the bow of battle, from him every ruler, all of them together. Now, the word ruler there in New American Standard is really the word oppressor, tyrant. And the reason they've switched it in New American Standard, it didn't fit their theology. Because everywhere else that it is, it means tyrant and oppressor. But they didn't like the Messiah being called the oppressor, so they made it ruler. I don't know what to do with that either, except unless it's tyrant in the sense of the wicked. That's what they're trying to get with ruler. But the word just means someone who oppresses. I think it's saying that leadership will come from Judah, and I'm not sure it's trying to be more specific than that.
How about despot?
Despot would be fine. That's the Septuagint translates the Greek word for despot, despotes, right here. So, but I think it's saying leadership will come from Judah. And I think it doesn't mean to say a whole lot more than that. But that's also a messianic kind of reference, right? Judah is the tribe the Messiah comes from. So, I can't be dogmatic on that, but it seems to me it fits. Because later on, over in verse 11 and 12, we're going to have another reference of a name that doesn't fit, and that's just the Messiah. So, the context seems to have some messianic implications. Now, then in verse 5, and they will be as mighty men, treading down the enemy. And notice the enemy's in italics, it's not there. Treading down in the mires of the street in battle, and they will fight for the Lord. They will fight, for the Lord will be with them. Now, the Lord with them is a reference back to the holy war days of the conquest of Canaan. God with them, a trumpeter in battle, you know, and all that, a buckler. God as warrior is a common Old Testament theme, and that seems to be the idea here. I think it probably goes back to that Joshua period for an allusion. Because you see, right after they came back to the land, Israel didn't fight anybody. They didn't overthrow Persia. Now, many, remember if you were here a couple of weeks ago, we did the last few chapters, you remember that some people think that this is a reference to what particular period? Anybody remember? When Israel did overthrow somebody. Maccabean. And they would say what this is a reference to the overthrow of the Seleucid leaders during the Maccabean period. That's a possibility there. I really think it's eschatological, which means I think it's end time, linked with the Messiah, not linked with the little nation of Israel struggling just to survive right after the Persian Empire came. May refer to the Maccabean, but I think the ultimate fulfillment's in the last day. And riding on horses will be put to shame. What means with God with you, even Calvary isn't big enough, you know. For foot soldiers, Calvary were overwhelming. But if God's on your side, no matter what comes against you, it won't be overwhelming. That's the idea. Then notice it says, "And I shall strengthen the house of Judah, and I shall save the house of Joseph." Now, if you don't remember, the post-exilic period, and really most of the 8th century prophets, which would be Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, all those biggies, if you don't realize that the people of God have split and there's two nations, you're going to be really confused. Now, let's go back quickly over these historical pegs I keep trying to give you about four or five dates to hang your hats on. When Solomon died and his son came to the throne, the nation split, Rehoboam, Jeroboam. It split in 922 B.C. And from that time on, there are two peoples of God. The northern 10 tribes called House of Joseph, which is the, and Ephraim is the usual title because Ephraim is one of the sons of Joseph. So Ephraim, Samaria, Israel, those are all the northern 10 tribes. Now, the southern two tribes are usually called Judah, Zion, the house of God, that kind of thing. Those are the southern two. So when it links Judah and the house of Joseph, it's saying they're still divided, but God's bringing them back together. Now, remember, if you would, the northern nation fell in 722 to Assyria. And they took them out of the land and dispersed them in the Media area. Okay, the area of Media, North Babylon, North Persia. And they really dispersed the hound out of them till they lost all cultural identity. Now, the southern two tribes weren't taken captive till 586 B.C. under Babylon, not Assyria. They were put in one place by the river Kibar, a canal, close to the city of Babylon, on the plains of the Tigris-Euphrates river valleys. And they kept their cultural identity. So when they were allowed to come home in 538 under Cyrus, the southern tribe that was still had their customs around that area Kibar where Ezekiel ministered, they're the ones that came back. These northern 10 tribes were so dispersed, so amalgamated that very few came back. But what this promises is that more will be drawn back as the years go by. Okay? So it continues. Because I have had compassion on them, and they will be as though I had not rejected them, for I am the Lord their God, and I will answer them. Now that little phrase, I am the Lord their God, it just seems so minor to us in English. But what that was saying, remember that the exile was God finally breaking the covenant with his people. They had broken over and over and over and over again, and he had forgiven them and tried to work with them and send the finally he said, I'm washing my hands of you, my spirit's leaving the temple. You can have it. I'm no longer your God. You're no longer my people. And he broke the covenant. Well, now the very fact he says, I am your God, means that covenant is back in place. It's been restored. It's been redone. It's back in place. And it's so significant if you were a Jew during this time. Then verse 7, and Ephraim will be like a mighty man. Now, Ephraim and the house of Joseph are synonymous, the northern 10 tribes. And look at the last one. And their heart will be glad as if from wine. Okay? Now, I want to say a word to you. In Psalms 104, verse 15, it says that wine is a gift of God that gladdens the hearts of men. It's awful tough for Baptists to take, but it's right there. I didn't write it. Psalms 104:15. You look at it yourself. Wine has always been something that's been related to God's activity. Let me tell you why. These people were acting kind of strange. They're going around giggling, singing during the day. You know, here they are, little people struggling. They're singing, happy. Everybody says, they're crocked. They've drank too much. That's their problem. Now, you know, that's not an uncommon biblical thing. Remember on the day of Pentecost, Peter got to preach. Everybody said, oh, they've just had too much to drink. Peter doesn't say, no, we don't drink. He says, it's too early, folks. It's still morning. We don't drink this early. So you look at Acts chapter 2, verse 13, and then Acts chapter 2, 15. So the people on Pentecost were acting a little unusual. And the people said, it's wine. It wasn't. It was the Holy Spirit. But there's, you know. And then look again at Ephesians chapter 5, verse 18, which says, do not be filled with wine, which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit. Well, now, the reason that's put together is that people who are filled with the Spirit are going to act a little unusual. And one of the answers is going to be they've drank too much. No. So, being filled with the Spirit has this ideal of release, joy, maybe not taking everything so seriously. You know, and that's the idea here. So, Ephraim is going to be like a man who sat down and is just smiling. Okay. Indeed, their children will see it and be glad. Now, what this is, that may not mean... See what we do in English, if we just read over this so easy. If you had been in captivity, if your children... Remember Jeremiah said, the children will die in the streets of starvation. They'll hunt the garbage heaps for food. They'll eat one another, but they're going to die in the streets. Can you imagine your little kids dying of hunger in the streets? Can you imagine what a trauma that must have been? Well, as those little ones died of hunger, now the children are going to tell their children and going to tell their children. What have we got? Social stability and prosperity restored. And the metaphor is their children will see it and be glad. Okay? Remember in the Ten Commandments where it says, if you honor your father and your mother, your days will be long in the land which the Lord your God gives you. Many folks have taken that as a personal promise of longevity. If you're good to your folks, you'll live longer. That is not at all what it's talking about. It's saying the society that has that kind of social structure will stay in the land a long time. Social stability. Well, that's the promise here in a little different way. Okay. Their heart will rejoice in the Lord. Now, by the way, notice there's going to be a spiritual return. God is, you know, the nation of Israel today is not a spiritual nation. Do you know only 5% of the entire Jewish nation goes to synagogue? The rest go to the beach. The nation right now in Palestine is the national Jewish state, but it is not the spiritual Jewish state of the end time in the Bible. There has to be a tremendous return to the Lord, and it's not there now. Now, they'll kill you for their land, but I'm not sure they're real zealous for the Lord. So, verse 8, and I will whistle for them and gather them together. Now, many people say, and I don't know where they get this from because I can't find any reference to it, that beekeepers in Palestine could take their bees out to a field, whistle, and the bees would leave the hive and go to the flowers. Whistle again, the bees would come back to the hive. I never met that smart of a bee. Ones I meet just sting me and go, you know, so I can't find, that's what they think it is. I think it's more of a hissing. Have you ever called someone like, psst, psst? Well, that's what I think this is. But it's a hiss that the people of God recognize as being God's hiss, okay? So what he's saying is, psst. That's the idea. God will gather them with a whistle or a hiss, okay? For I have redeemed them. The word redeem is a beautiful word. It means to buy somebody back from slavery, to buy back a prisoner of war. Man is trapped in a situation. He cannot help himself. It's what the kinsman redeemer does for a relative. It's what God does for his people. Now, the beauty of it is this. Every metaphor in the Bible is a personal metaphor when described to God. He is a husband. He is a parent. He is the nearest kin that buys back. You see how those personal metaphors occur? And so that's what this is here. And they will be as numerous as they once were, or they were before. Now, that's part of the Abrahamic covenant. Remember when God first talked to Abraham in chapter 12, and he talked to him again in 13, 14, and 15? In Genesis 13, 16, he says, you're going to be as numerous as the dust or the sand of the sea. In Genesis 15, 5, he says, you're going to be as numerable as the stars of heaven. So what it is, it's a re-gearing of this covenant. They had been emaciated number-wise. Thousands had been killed. God's promising numbers are going to be back. Okay? I will scatter them among the people. Now, the word here is so. Now, it can be done for two reasons. It can mean so out of punishment. That's possible. It'd be a reference to what? the exile or some future dispersion are. If you read it, it doesn't sound like judgment. It sounds like something else. Let me read it to you. I will scatter them among the peoples. They will remember me in the far countries, and they with their children will live and come back. Could it be, just possibly, can't be dogmatic, just possibly, if this is the end time reference, could it be a dispersion for evangelism instead of a dispersion for punishment? Could it be we've scattered through all the nations of the world for the purpose of telling them about God instead of for judgment? Well, I think it's a possibility, though it's not very specific in the text, okay? Then it mentions, and I will bring them back from the land of Egypt and gather them from the land of Assyria. Now, man, red lights will start going off. Nobody was exiled in Egypt that we know about from the Babylonian exile. None. Now, some ran down there in the last part of Jeremiah to get away from the Babylonians, but they didn't have to stay. I think what we have here is this biblical use of using old enemies to exemplify future enemies. Egypt and Assyria were two of the traditional enemies of the people of God. Syria representing all of that Fertile Crescent crowd, okay? That Assyria, Babylon, Persia, that whole world empire from that Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. Egypt was the other problem, the Nile River Valley. Israel had a problem with both, okay? So I think what's happening, it's saying, these two traditional enemies, which are representative here of all the enemies of God's people, all right, notice again, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon. Now, they are, that is part of the promised land originally. So what he's saying is, I'm going to bring so many of you back that there's not going to be room for even the farthest limits of the promised land. The most ideal limits of the promised land won't be able to hold all the people of God in this day. Now, that does not fit for the exile. Why? Because we think less than 50,000 Jews returned. Now, 50,000 Jews won't fill up Palestine, much less need more land. So I think we're talking about a future return, not a contemporary return. Now, look at verse 11. And he will pass through the sea. Now, I want to ask you a question. When those of you who have New American Standard, why is he capitalized? It's not the first word in the sentence. What are the translators trying to tell you? They think it's the Messiah. Now, does King James have he capitalized? No. Okay. Does anybody else have? Oh, you didn't have and? Does anybody have a Revised Standard Version or Living Bible or anything like that? Yeah, that, I think it has he, doesn't it, capitalized? It's verse 11, the second word. Verse 11. I think it does. Now, there's one more place that I think is real funny. Now, look at the last two lines, 12. And I shall strengthen them in the Lord. In his name they will walk, declares the Lord. Now, man, there's something wacko there. Let me read that again. I, that's God speaking, right? Would you grant that? That's the Father. I will strengthen them in the Lord. Now look at the second one. In his name they will walk, declares the Lord. Now, we got two people there. There's two persons there. Because we got two different subjects, or at least nominative forms. We have I and in the Lord in the verse phrase. And we got his name, and they will walk in, declares the Lord. Now, you see what's happening? We got two Lords, if you please. Now, what I think we have is the Psalms 110 deal. The Lord said to my Lord, you know, Jesus and the Father. So it seems to me that because the translators, at least of New American Standard, think the he of verse 11 is the Messiah, and we've got two different people in verse 12, that this certainly is a messianic psalm, combined with that him back over there in verse 4. Now, he will pass through the sea of distress and strike the waves in the sea, and so shall all the depths of the Nile will dry up, and the pride of Assyria will be brought down, the scepter of Egypt will depart. Now, those are historical ways of saying what? He's going to take over. He's in charge. Now, the idea about walking through the sea of distress, maybe I'm reading too much. He's going to have problems. There's going to be struggles. It's not going to be just an immediate overthrow. He's going to walk through this valley of deep darkness with his people. And it seems to me there's some reference here, veiled though it may be, to this suffering servant ideal of Isaiah. How specific, I just don't know. Exactly what it means, the depths of the Nile and all that, I think it's just poetry. And I don't think we can push poetry too far. You know, you push poetry too far, you really get as bad as you don't say enough. So, well, let me look at these questions with you and see what you think. Why does this chapter seem to point beyond the return from the exile? Could you answer that? If you had, say, five or six blanks, what would you say? Why do you think this chapter points beyond Zechariah's day? Okay. Okay, talks about both of them. I also think it talks about the diviners and all of that, and that's not Zechariah's day. That's before Zechariah's day. And then you got all these people returning, so there's no room for them. That's not Zechariah's day. So I think there's several points through here we could say it just doesn't fit. Okay, is the Messiah mentioned this chapter where? Well, it's only speculation, but I think verse 4, verse 11 and 12, for me, it's the Messiah. And then, why do people of God in the Old Testament go by so many different names? Well, it's because they played the fool and split. and through history, they were known by different names. And it gets very confusing. That's just the way it is. And you either learn it and deal with it or get fouled up when you read through these prophets. And questions or comments? Yeah.
In that verse where he was capitalized, in my Cambridge edition, it refers back to Isaiah 11:15.
Okay, what's that say?
Identical verse that has definite reference to the Lord doing the same action.
Isaiah 11:14, 11:15. Okay, it's referring to the Sea of Egypt there. Okay. I didn't list Isaiah 11:15. I think it's a possible allusion. I don't know how specific I'd make it, but that may be... Isaiah 51. Mine has Isaiah 51:9. I wonder what that is. Isaiah 51:9. Hope you have a cross-reference Bible. That doesn't do any better. It's a dry-up-the-sea ideal, too. But okay, thank you, Monty. Somebody else? Would you be willing to bet your life that your interpretation of this is right? I don't know, this is... This
is this who's listening? Some governmental agency doesn't come down and say, hey, you bet your life you were wrong.
No, the whole key is, it's just when people get dogmatic on passages like this, it's a pretty good sign they got some a hidden agenda going. They got some preconceived notions they're trying to back up. The Bible really throws a lot of light on Bible commentaries. And sometimes they go way too far in what they can prove. So be careful. Don't try to say too much. Don't try to say too little. Say what you can. Feel comfortable with what is certain. Do not push and be dogmatic on what is ambiguous. Okay.